We're starting another division, the longest division, in this first apologetic section, the existence of God, page 12, middle of the page. Part 3, the teleological argument. The word comes from the word teleos in the Greek, T-E-L-I-O-S, which means end or finish or complete or bring to a full. And therefore it has been called final cause. In true teleology, we should separate this from eutaxiology. It's closely linked with the cosmological argument and in fact issues from it. In the cosmological, we inquire into the cause of things we experience, but in the teleological, we look behind the cause to the design or purpose of it. The reason. And all science proceeds upon this basis. They know that there is no such thing as something that doesn't have a reason. It doesn't tend towards something. Fulfilled something. And yet they deny that there is a God. Strange. They don't do that, we shall see, in any other work of man. Period. Not only do we come to the conclusion that everything had an adequate cause, but in searching for that cause we see design. And where there's design, there must be a designer. Sometimes called adaptation. The human mind automatically inquires, what's that for? Why? What's the reason? When you see anything, all of its parts perfectly adapted to each other, fulfilling some kind of a function, what is the function? But then reasoning back, we have to reason that it must have had a designer, a planner, a creator. The anatomist always looks for the purpose of an organ of the body. Here's why they came to what they called vestigial organs. There was over 100 of them when they first started. Now they've got about 2 or 3 left, and you don't hear any more about the appendix being a vestigial organ. You know now that it serves a real purpose. So does the tonsils. For a while there, if a doctor didn't know anything else to do for you, he took your tonsils out. Or if you had a car payment due. Just perversely. Now I had mine out, and there wasn't anything wrong with them. I had another operation, and they decided, I guess, that 2 for 1, or you could charge a whole lot more. But I've always been sorry I had my tonsils out. I swallow half my stuff down my windpipe, and naturally it doesn't digest. It has to come back up again. I have to cough it out. Great big hole in my throat where my tonsils are supposed to keep it out of there, I guess. But all kinds of other... Did you know it? When Darwin was giving this thing out, every one of the endocrine glands was a vestigial organ. I think there were 8 of them, aren't there? All of them we must have needed them when we were monkeys climbing around in trees. When we was a tadpole in primeval ooze or something. But now you don't hear too much about vestigial organs. Oh, they still give this little piece of tailbone you got coming the end of your spine as a vestigial organ. It's silly because too many muscles are attached to it, and I guess you couldn't walk it without that little nub sticking out of your backbone. I don't think that's little piece of a great big hairy tail with which you hung from a limb on a tree back there a million years ago. They know that every organ in the body serves a purpose. Now, and the secret is to find out what the purpose is. And then a lot of times, if it doesn't serve that purpose, then they can determine what's wrong with you. The law of causation proves that there is an all-powerful force which is adequate to bring about every effect you see in nature. But teleology, finding design and purpose in nature, shows that this adequate cause must have been an intelligent cause. You see how deeper we're going into the whole law of causation. Personality. If there is intelligent design, the cause must itself be intelligent. You see that in every contrivance, in every machine. Causation just shows the presence of force, infinite force, adequate force, capable of producing the well-nigh infinite variety of force and effects. But from it alone, we can't determine personality. But teleology shows that that force, since there is infinite, not only infinite variety and infinite beauty and infinite pattern, infinite system, but there must be also design or purpose in everything, since it fulfills it. But intellect is only a product of personality. Animals don't have it. Not what you call real intellect. We shall see some of the parts of the intellect. An amoeba cell doesn't have intellect when it squeezes out a little pseudopodium out, that's a false foot, out to seize a hold of something, and then it bobs all around it and absorbs it. It doesn't size up the outfit and say, well, now that looks like a pretty good piece of meat. Let's see if it's a beefsteak or pork. Doesn't care. It automatically evaluates and eats it, or spits it out again. Therefore, if the cause of all the contrivances of nature, the systems, the laws of nature, must have all the attributes of personality, to an infinite degree, which are found in every other personality in finite degree. Here our understanding of the first cause is increased to include the fact that he is personal, living, possessing memory, conscience, judgment, volition, perception, cognition, emotion, all the powers of reasoning and thought. This is the inevitable road of teleology. Let me illustrate. Whittaker Chambers was an atheist and a spy, but he got amnesty at the trial of Alger Hiss, spy trial, in the famous pumpkin paper case. In his book, Witness, W-I-T-N-E-S-S, he tells of the turning point in his life. Somewhat like Colson, Chuck Colson. He tells of the turning point in his life when disillusioned with communism, which he got in college, and he lost his atheism. He was one day in the garden watching his little daughter at play. And unconsciously, and this is all in that book, Witness, Unconsciously, he became aware of the shape of her ear. And he thought to himself, how impossible that such intricate, delicate convolutions serving a purpose could have been caused by chance. The beautiful shape. Yet the purpose of the shape to catch just exactly right the sound waves and then channel them down into the ear itself. He said they could have only come by premeditated design, his atheistic mind said. He quickly caught up his thoughts. He didn't want to. He said I pushed them from my mind. And because he realized the next logical step or sequence would have to be design presupposes a designer, and that designer has to be intelligent. Therefore, the God of the Bible must be the true God. He knew it. And he tried to keep it out. He wasn't ready yet to accept it. But he finally had to accept it. And he became a believer. A born-again believer, no doubt, from his own testimony. And all of this came out at his trial. Public trials in the papers. We can state it syllogistically, and I want to change one part of the syllogism in the conclusion. There's a law of the syllogism called the middle term. The middle term must be in all three propositions, or it's not logical. And you won't find it logical then in your notes. I'll make it logical. It's on the third one, and we'll change it. But notice the first one, the major premise. Order, harmony, design are only the products of intelligence. Everywhere you look. Second, the minor premise, there is order, harmony, and design in nature. Everywhere. We'll see that in the very term system, law, adaptation. Here's the funny thing. Every evolutionary book I've got in my library, I've got lots of them. And I've read them all. I've got a couple from Yale. I've got Bob Ingersoll's. Quite a few others. There is order, harmony, and design in nature. Now here's the conclusion. The order and design in nature is a product of intelligence only. Therefore, the conclusion follows all the way through our subject. If nature is so well nigh infinite, it must be God. This intelligence, this is going, this taking the conclusion to its ultimate conclusion. We wish to, we didn't do it in your notes, so I want you to put it in your notes here on the top of A. Right over first consideration, put eutaxiology. You notice it's in that paragraph, eutaxiological, for an adjective. But the noun, eutaxiology, eutaxiology, right over the first consideration in teleology. This is eutaxiology. That's design, order, not plan, but beauty, harmony. True teleology is the end in view, or design, or purpose. Therefore, we separate it, and we'll separate it in your notes. As we say, we wish to to separate the teleological argument into two of its primary divisions. The first is the eutaxiological argument. Well arranged is what it means. From this prefix, EU. Well arranged. The presence of plan, design, geometric proportions, beauty, order in nature. Second, division will be the final cause or true teleological purpose, adaptation or intention in nature. Utility, someone has said, is the yardstick of apologetics. James McCosh gives these two laws in typical forms in Creation, page 30. He says, order in heaven, or no, order is heaven's first law. And the second is like unto it. Everything serves a purpose. Heaven's laws. McCosh, typical forms in Creation, page 30. Order is heaven's first law. And the second is like unto it. Everything serves an end. That's why science always looks for this second one. The end. What's it for? What's the ear for? Hang your glass tackles on? Or keep your hat from coming down over your eyes? Nope. The primary reason for the ear is to hear. There may be some secondary ones, like your eyes. It's to let love light shine out. It's to flash anger. It's to look demure, for that is. Nope. The primary idea of the eyes is to see. And the 30 or so million pieces to it get together just right to do that job. If you don't have something wrong with them. We'll use the eye later because it's tremendous. He also says, now like this, and I want to quote it. On page 439 of the same book, Typical Forms in Creation, James McCosh wrote a little over 100 years ago. He was a tremendous man. He taught at Oxford for a while. He taught in New England States. I've forgotten which college. On page 439 of the same book, he gives four principles in all civil architecture, which I call planned order. Never accidental. No architecture is ever accidental. It's planned. These four laws are, one, convenience. These are not in your notes. First one is convenience. Second one is symmetry. S-Y-M-E-T-R-Y. Symmetry. The third one is balance. It's called eurythma. Harmony. Perfect proportion. The word eurythma is U-E-U, you'll find it in the dictionary. U-E-U-R-Y-T-H-M-A. Eurythma. And the fourth one is ornament. I'll name them again. Convenience, symmetry, balance, ornament. And he says, not one of these is lacking in nature. In every organism, in every mineral, I don't care what it is in nature, these four are there. And here's a wonderful statement, and I want to quote it. Same book, same page. The presence of any one of these four might be sign, but the presence of all four in their concurrence is overwhelming in the proof of God. He goes on to say, we do not know whether to admire most the all-pervading order which reigns throughout all of nature, through all the parts of the plant and animal, and through the hundreds and myriads of different species of parts and animals. Or a skillful accommodation of every part and every organ in every species to the purpose which they were meant to serve. See why I like to read after this guy? I buy anything in the world I can find in a second-hand bookstore. They're not in print any longer, but you look for them. James McCosh. Capital M-C, capital C-O-S-H. McCosh. James McCosh. I have 4 of his books. I wish I had his book on intuitions. Now, coming to your notes, under A, page 13. The eutaxiological argument, or design, pattern, form, geometric proportions. I would like for you to pass around these microscopic pictures of the diatoms. I want you to see the designs and purposes of these things. Taxiology. And I will pass this one around probably if you want to. I got this from a man out in Arkansas, a friend of mine. He's, I want you to notice the almost, I guess, the thousands upon thousands of each little crystals here. I've got one of these that weighs 32 pounds, one crystal that weighs 32 pounds, made just exactly like these little ones. These were, he got these out of a cave, and these were formed by certain minerals dropping from a stalactite in a cave out there. And he broke this one off and brought it to me, and brought me another one, a paperweight, oh, about that high, and then this great big one. I wasn't going to bring that. That's too heavy to carry it. It weighs about 40 pounds. And just one of these little things grown in a great big one. Maybe you might want to see these. I say in your notes, using the ultra meaning of design or pattern or order of structure, intricate design, traceable everywhere, we shall see this one man called this geometry crystallized in one book that I have by Mendenhall. Let us consider the substitute creator of the atheistic evolutionists. Always capitalize it. Law. L-A-W. Working only by blind chance or nature, capital N. Almost always. We won't take the time to quote from too many, but I want to quote from Ernest Heinrich Haeckel, H-A-E-K-E-L. He was a collaborator with Darwin for a while, and he made a lot of foolish statements back in his day, pre-scientific days. He wrote a book called The History of Creation, strange name for it. I want to give volume 1, page 176. To show you how, what they say. Quotation marks. All the different forms of organisms which people are usually inclined to look upon as the product of creative power, acting for a definite purpose, we, according to the theory of selection, can conceive as the necessary product of natural selection, working without a purpose. End of quotation. That's a scientist talking. A natural scientist. Can blind force, unintelligent, unconscious intelligence, natural law, chance, bring together, build, animate the vast multitude of corresponding balancing functions in the human body? Do they work? Ordinarily, if you don't have something go wrong or an accident or abuse it, in fact, you take for granted. Everything works good. Until something goes wrong with it. Why? By chance. How in the world could the 7,000 billion cells in the human body, each one a little organism, individually we should see in embryology, how could those 7,000 billion, now you'll find all kinds of variations here because people are not all the same size, but in the average person there are 7,000 billion cells. And each cell is a cosmos all of its own. He's talking about the simple cell. You know, now it's nothing simple about it at all. In fact, it has billions of parts in each cell, in the atoms of it. And each one is programmed. You know, if nature could bring it together every last, some way or other, in a great big another explosion, not a big bang, but a little bang, get together all the different parts for the body. Now, you tell me how I could get them in ears and eyes and nose and throat and all the parts of the body. Now, what good would those cells be without the DNA tape, the programmer? I'm going to give the DNA tape later. It absolutely... I don't know how any science could study the genetics and the DNA tape and be an atheist. I don't see how. It's utterly inconceivable to me that this thing could be accidental. Here's why most of them have had to finally come to some Elan Vital or some life force or some energizing intelligent force in nature that somehow or other makes everything work. We know that every once in a while there is a genetic accident. And when it happens, it threatens the life, and it's usually destroyed before any time at all. We shall see this in mutations. Yes? Oh, of course, yeah. And willingly ignorant. I believe this with all my heart. We'll see this at the end of the section. Or end of the whole thing. God uses the 105 elements. They're really about 99 or 100 in nature. The rest are made man-made by nuclear fission and nuclear fusion. But of the some 100 building blocks in nature, or the atomic construction, everything in all the mega-universe is made out of these 100 elements. I don't care what it is. You can't think of a thing materially made that isn't made out of it. Remember, spirit is not made out of it. There's a pamphlet put out by a man by the name of Rogers. It's called Rogers' Reasoning. He was a multimillionaire, and he owned a meat factory. And he did a whole lot like some other precious friends of mine, like the man I bought my Oldsmobile from in Asheville. He tries to win every one of his salesmen and everybody else to Christ. He puts a New Testament in every car he sells in the glove compartment, and he has meetings in it. And various evangelists come in, and he has all of his workers come in, and they get religion choked down their throat. They say, I guess. But he wrote this little book, Rogers' Reasons, and one of the statements he makes in it, one of the paragraphs goes like this. It takes 2 hours to assemble the 17 parts of a meat chopper. He said, if you put those 17 parts in a wash tub and shake it, how long would you have to shake it before it assembles into a meat chopper? You could shake forever. We'll give the laws of probability a little later. Nobody is fool enough to say about any mechanical thing that you've got, it came by a fortuitous concourse of atoms. Or an explosion in the automobile factory in Detroit. It just doesn't look that way. Blind force or unconscious intelligence, whatever that is. Natural law is the god of creation for the atheist. But to speak of blind force as using intelligent forethought and supervision is absolute foolishness. In the whole realm of nature or mankind, to prove it. To speak of them as using intelligent forethought and supervision without intelligent lawgiver is as nonsensical as to speak of the laws of the Commonwealth of Florida without a cop or a judge or a legislator. Man has found out that certain forces always work along a given line, and they call them laws, but they don't make anything. It's just the way God made it. Now let's look at three laws. There are two in your notes, and I want to give one outside your notes. Well, these three laws of motion. Then I want to give another one later on. In Kepler's, his name is Johannes Kepler, in his Principia, or Principles in the English, they still hold good. I love these great thinkers. They were Christians, by the way. Kepler was a man of God, as Newton was. Notice the bottom of page 13. The first one is the law of inertia. There's been a line left out in your notes. Some typist in days gone by got tired or sleepy about 12 o'clock at night when she was typing his notes. And I slipped over a line. Let me add it. Right after the law of inertia. Put a little B there and then put this sentence up above it. Anybody, that's not anybody, anybody, two words, at rest. Anybody at rest will stay so forever. Why they call it the law of inertia. Anybody at rest will stay at rest forever unless an external force sets it in motion. It has to come without. All energy is from without. Then into your notes. Now let me go through it again and then back to your notes. Anybody at rest will stay so forever unless an external force sets it in motion. And the rest of it, anybody once set in motion must move forever in a straight line with uniform velocity, providing no force acts upon it to stop it. Now, these three laws of inertia let scientists know before they ever tried a rocket in outer space that a rocket would work, even though I had no air to push against. Because it exerts a force back that way, and every action has a reaction. So therefore, even has nothing to push against. Now, a propeller has to have some air to grab hold of. Even your earthly jet engine has to have air to push against. That's your rocket engine. Here's why they have little teeny tiny jets in to correct all the kind of things in spaceships. Doesn't take very much juice, much to work it. Science knows no energy from without. Plato, before Christ, said no motion without a mover. Yet Heraclitus, in 5 BC, all nature's in flux. Perpetual change is the order of all nature. Where did change start? In this first law of inertia. In the beginning, God. Take him out and you've got another mystery against the law of inertia. The second law, any force acting upon a moving body, its deviation from the straight line will be in the direction of the force applied and proportionate to the force. Then the third law of motion, from which Einstein worked out his famous law of gravity. Action and reaction are equal upon every particle of matter in the universe. Remember, the law of relativity is you can change matter into energy and energy back into matter, but the sum total is never decreased. All you do is change it from one thing into another. You can change matter into gas, gas into matter, but you haven't destroyed or created anything. The sum total remains the same. And the whole law of gravity is built upon this man's conception of the law of gravity, though he didn't know what it is. So the Bible says God weighed the mountains in a scale. We want to skip down just a little ways. I want you to read these, all of these, but starting down in, toward the bottom of page 14, second paragraph, from the bottom. Now, approaching our first line of argument from the eutaxological argument, the presence of method, design, pattern, order, harmony, beauty, and nature, from that I reason, those can only be the product of intelligence. Therefore, they must have had an architect, a designer. Am I to forsake all the logic and common sense I would use in the exploration of the ruins of a lost civilization, where I postulate a designer when I see a ruined building? Yet when I look in nature and see all kinds of designs and patterns, am I to deny a creator? Now the first proof, and these are not going to take us a whole long time, we're going to prove the eutaxiological argument first from the presence of geometric proportion in nature. I want to quote from Mendenhall in his book Plato and Paul, another good book if you can find it anywhere. Mendenhall, M-E-N-D-E-N-H-A-L-L, Mendenhall, Plato and Paul, page 138. The multitudinous forms of nature are not the accidental results of attrition, of unguided force, but the careful expression of exact geometric ideas showing a plan. You saw it in this little piece of rock. You saw it in all these little diatoms And when they blew them up a little bit more, how absolutely beautiful they are. How wonderful. Now, we'll see as we go along, the further down you go in microphotography, the more wonderful it becomes, the more exact, the more intricate. We shall see man's are not made like that. Nothing man makes. Don't look too closely to anything man makes. The closer you look, worse it looks. But not what God makes. I'll show you a mosquito's proboscis before long, a little later in the other section of apologetics. Enlarge 5,000 times. And then one a little bit larger than that. And almost makes me afraid of a mosquito. Now, see the ugly rascal close up. Let me continue with Mendenhall. The circle, the ellipse, are embodied in the orbits of the spheres and the spheres themselves. And angles of every name are illustrated in crystals and ores. And physiological construction of animals and plants. Number is the ideal of the universe. You'll see the angles on every one of those little crystals in that stone. When God made man, He made him with the same abhorrence of imbalance. It's ingrained in man to abhor an unbalanced dwelling, painting, statue. Plato's maxim was, deity proceeds by geometry. You could see in every one of those things he was showing you. In fact, when Whistler first painted his mother's picture, Whistler's mother, the picture was unbalanced, and it looked like the old lady was just getting ready to slide off the chair. And every morning when Whistler came back into his study, the picture was lopsided, but she looked like she was comfortable again. The cleaning lady every day would straighten it out so the old lady was sitting straight. You know what he did? He painted the picture on the wall. That balanced it. Now the old lady doesn't look like she's about to get off her rocker. Everything that man does, he tries to get geometric with it. I don't know if you doodle or not. Doodling is a tremendous thing. Psychologists make a lot out of doodling. But I have watched all the doodlings I've done. A lot of times you do it if you're bored. I'd like to see any kind of writing anybody in my church does while I'm preaching. I may make you hand yours in about my teachings. But I've noticed in my doodlings, if I make a line over here, I've got to make a line over here. They're always balanced. If I make a building, I'd like to do that. I'm kind of geometric. I'll draw all kinds of designs for windows in it. But if I put a window on this side of the fireplace, I've got to put one on the other. Of course, we put another room on the house up in North Carolina, and I had to take that window out and put a door over there. It's not quite as balanced as it ought to be. It hadn't made me get off my rocker yet, but we don't like to see an imbalance. You'll find this in nature. A tree, if it loses a limb, grow another one. The first thing you know, it's going to be even. In the whole vegetable world, you can see it, form, pattern, design, geometric proportions. We won't go into it, but sometime if you ever get a chance to study why the leaves are so arranged in nature, and by the way, a lot of the various genus of plants is determined by how the leaves go around the limb and the proportion of them, but they're proportioned. If a limb has leaf on this side, it has one on that side. You can see it in all the various kinds of trees.
Yes. Since geometric balance has to do with uniformity, why does Morris always connect uniformity with evolution? Why does uniformity always connect with evolution? I can see uniformity a lot.
Well, I can too. I think they're very ununiform, especially in the balancing of their equal treatment for anything. There's a bias there that's way out in left field. I hadn't noticed that, by the way. This balancing in nature is called the law of phyllotaxy. You notice it in the second paragraph in the bottom or the third paragraph in the bottom. You ever wonder why the human body is so balanced? Maybe we'd go crazy if we had our two eyes like this. Even a flounder, which has two eyes on the top side of one side of the body, as it had two right like this, but then it went to the bottom and lies on the bottom, and one eye migrates. It's not born with two eyes on one side of the head. But it is after it comes toward adulthood. Why is it that when God put an ear on this side, he put one on this side? The human body is tremendously balanced, and so is all the animal kingdom. God, all of nature. Harmony. As you saw in this crystallography, if I had time, I'd go into what one teacher gave us when I was in school. One of our special speakers was E.J. Pace, cartoonist for the Sunday School Times for over 40 years. Tremendous man. I have his little book on the law of the octave. In class, he gave us in music, in harmony. Why is the law of the octave, the law of beginning, always on the eighth one? And perfectly balanced. This is a law in all of nature. Balance. Every snowflake, unless something outside of itself interferes with it. But if it falls without interference, the law of the octave is written upon every snowflake that falls. I meant to bring that little book that he gave us, The Law of the Octave. There's some pictures of the snowflakes. You've seen them, though, and Reader's Digest has them once in a while, others. Like a doily. Eight-sided figures. And the remarkable thing is, out of every snowflake that falls in every snowstorm, and how many fall? Even in the lightest one. This man that started this microphotography of the snowflake, it wasn't E.J. Pace, but he borrowed from him. This man said that he had taken over 10,000 pictures at that time of snowflakes under a microscope. And he said no two were alike. But everyone had the law of the octave written. Our God is a God of order. Design. He's a designer. He's an architect. And he's written that upon our own natures. We'll develop that just a little bit more in this eutaxiological argument. Then I want to hurry up and get into the teleological, because that's where I have most of my illustrations I want to give. And especially the wonders of the human body. And I want to get into embryology. I don't know how in the world a man can be a obstetrician and not be a Christian and study embryology at all. You're dismissed.